The history of Christianity is very linear from the time of Jesus to 1500, we'll say. And even in the midst there, the Catholic Church kind of splits, and we have Eastern Christianity and Western Christianity. You have Orthodox churches in the East. You have Roman Catholicism in the West. But even still, those two interacted a lot, and they were much more similar than they were different. When you get to the Protestant Reformation in the 1500s, everything just shatters and splinters and begins moving in all kinds of different directions. And, I mean, it's a fair question. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? You know, the unity of the church for all those years really served it well, but it also made it ripe for corruption and whenever the church was unified and had all this power, then governmental leaders really, you know, wanted to have influence over it because they felt like if we have influence over the church, we can, you know, move our countries or move our empires wherever it is we want them to go. And so I don't know that if it's a good or a bad thing. It just is. I mean, it's probably both, characteristics of both. The 16th century, 1500 to 1600, when you think of Protestant Reformation, that's that time period. Martin Luther, John Calvin, Ulrich Zwingli. You have both of those. You have people who wanted to reform the Catholic Church from within. And so we have these conciliar movements. You have those who said the Catholic Church from within can't be reformed. And so we're going to break away and create our own, you know, church, build our own system. And the big movements Garrett talked about last week. So you have Martin Luther's followers that have kind of become a major group, and they begin identifying what are orthodox beliefs for Lutherans. Then you have John Calvin and Ulrich Zwingli's followers that were identified as Reformed, the Reformed Church, and they become a really predominant force and begin identifying what were their, what was orthodox for them. But apart from those two, you have all kinds of other movements. Well, and England, of course, being its own story, the Church of England, you know, separated from the Catholic Church, and we get Anglicanism and the Church of England moving out of that country. Of course, Spain is still very predominantly Catholic. Italy is still very predominantly Catholic. France, predominantly Catholic. But Germany, Holland, Britain, Portugal, Switzerland, and then even moving, you know, more towards the East. Man, Protestant is just, it's a catch-all term for all of these different spin-off movements. Once the dam had been breached, it was a trickle at first, and then it was, you know, the Catholic Church trying to plug, you know, 14 holes with only, you know, 10 fingers and 10 toes, 20 holes, 30 holes, however many. They didn't have enough fingers and toes. When we get to 1600, that's this time period we're looking at now, 1600 to 1800. So 200 years following the Reformation, but we're not really to, you know, the modern world yet, what we would identify as the modern world. This 200-year time period is going to be marked by a lot of denominational arguing and fighting, theological fighting, and then the responses to that. So really, for Lutheranism and for Reformed theology, the Reformed Church, 1600, we've developed a little bit of toleration. We're not fighting for our freedoms anymore. They were to some degree, but in large part, the government's leaving us alone. And so whenever we're not fighting for our freedoms, we turn our attention to theological squabbles. And the Calvinists and the Arminianists, you know, we looked at last week, that was predominant in Holland. Of course, the Lutherans identifying, solidifying their boundaries, their ideas. Really, if you go back and read the book of Ezra in the Old Testament, this is what the Israelites did. When they came back out of exile, they said, all right, we've come out of this, you know, harsh world, we need to really nail down exactly who we are and make sure we hold everybody accountable to following the laws. We didn't follow the laws. We got in trouble. We got exiled. God allowed us to come home. And so we need to make sure we follow the laws to the letter. And of course, this would have been in the 400s, 500s BC. But it was that kind of mentality that would lead eventually to what we see as the Pharisee way of life in the early New Testament that Jesus had such a combat with. What they were doing is they're building walls. It's why Nehemiah is paired with Ezra. Ezra comes back to build theological walls around the New Jerusalem. Nehemiah comes back to build the actual wall, bricks and mortar around. But they both were accomplishing the same purpose. We must defend ourselves from heresies coming from the outside. We must protect ourselves from anybody who doesn't think like us is the enemy. And so in this time period, 1600s, 1700s, all these new denominations are doing that. We're not fighting for our freedoms anymore, so let's start building our walls. What is it that defines us as Lutherans? What's our systematic theology? What is it that defines us as Calvinists? Let's build our systematic theology. What defines us as Church of England? Let's build our systematic theology. In the book, the writer, on a couple of occasions, once he's talking about Philip Melanchthon, who was Martin Luther's chief follower, and then Melanchthon's followers after he died, talking about them, and then also talking about the Westminster Confession and the Synod of Dort, which were the two big communications of the Reformed Church and their doctrines. He talks about how within about 100 years, the community of followers of Martin Luther and John Calvin really didn't look exactly like Martin Luther or John Calvin. They looked a whole lot more like the second and third generation leaders instead of the first generation leaders. This is, by the way, we're going to see much the same when we look at some of these characters tonight with George Fox and the Quakers, some of the philosophers and their movements. It didn't take long for the Lutherans to not look as much like Luther as Luther looked like Luther, for the Calvinists to not look as much like John Calvin as Calvin himself did. But so that was one of the responses. 1600s, 1700s, we start entrenching our theologies. Well, this led to a whole lot of arguing. Still arguing and squabbling and fighting. The Puritan movement, I know Garrett addressed that briefly a couple of weeks ago. The Puritan movement was predominantly reformers in England that saw in the Church of England things that they didn't like, and they felt like the church needed to be purified, hence the name. And so really, Church of England and Puritans was kind of a mini Reformation of what had taken place with the Roman Catholics and Martin Luther and John Calvin in the rest of Europe. And so just in England, Ireland, Scotland, you have this little back and forth between the state-run Church of England and these different splinter groups that were collectively referred to as Puritans that were trying to reform the church or start new religious groups. More fighting. This whole period, it's Christians fighting Christians. they just can't get along. When you look at what's taking place in the Muslim community today, there are certain instances in which the Islamic community are making war with Westerners, with Christians, but in large part, not only now, but going back 50 years, they've been fighting amongst themselves. They do far more violence to one another within their different strains of belief than they do anybody else. And we can look and think, how silly, how foolish, why can't they just get along? But about 300, 400 years ago, Christians were doing the exact same thing for a long period of time. So Puritans in the Church of England taking place in England. In the other parts of Europe, there were really three responses to this. And it's you'll see in the book on a couple of occasions, it talks about how some leader just got fed up with all of the theological, denominational arguing and infighting within Christianity. And they started thinking about things from a different angle. 1600 to 1800, we have 200 years. And the writer, Gonzalez, he kind of identifies three different ways of responding. He talks about the rationalist response, that some people looked at the state of the church and they didn't want to abandon their faith, but the scientific movement is upon us. We're learning more about the world. We're observing more. We're thinking more. It seems like our faith should also be given rational underpinnings if we're going to believe these things. And so in France, in Germany, in the Netherlands, we have philosophers and scholars that are from a religious bent, names like René Descartes, Voltaire, looking at the world and kind of saying, and a lot of these theological systems aren't supported by reason, but we think our faith can be supported by reason, and they start pushing down the rational path. Another response was the spiritist path. These are the folks that say, why can't we all just walk with Jesus and get along? Why can't we just... The attention was to their inner self. Why can't we just seek the Lord and love one another and get along? And they sought meaning not within some of these political movements and popes and bishops and systematic leaders, but the inner self. And then the third mode is, the third approach we're not going to talk about until spring break, 2 or 3 weeks down the line. He refers to it as the pietist approach. And that was more of the, you know, we need to separate from the government, and the church needs to represent God and follow Jesus. And it was kind of a medium path, but it didn't want to identify with government, and it didn't want to identify with big church. It's a very interesting dynamic when you think about that's taking place in the 1600s and 1700s. Compared to what's taking place in the Christian church in our country today. You still have people that are very disillusioned by the fractured nature of the church, very disillusioned by all the different theological positions and squabblings. And so some people kind of take the academic approach. The whole university and much of the university and seminary community, man, they're just kind of walled away from the rest of the church. And they are pursuing God based on pure reason and academia, and that's their path. Even within the church, you have others doing the same. You have those, we would identify them more as, you know, maybe the charismatic movement. The Bible is not as important. What's most important is what the Spirit speaks to me. They look a little bit different, but it's built on the same philosophy that the Bible is there, but the Bible's not as important as my personal experience and what the Spirit is speaking to me internally. And then you have those that say, well, we really want to follow God, but the denominational church and the government and the traditions, we want to abandon all of those and kind of move out on our own path. And so non-denominational Christianity, you'll never find a non-denominational church that in its theology and practice doesn't have a lot of characteristics of some denomination somewhere. But just the calling of ourselves, we are non-denominational. It's a recognition that we love the church and we love Jesus, but we're not real crazy about institutionalized church or denominational title or the fractured nature of our faith. And so we're just going to be such and such community church or, you know, non-denominational church or whatever the case may be. We've gone a long ways down the road, but these three responses are still heavily in favor today, and probably will be as long as the Christian church has so many different opinions and options. You're going to have those that just entrench in the big camps, the Catholics, the Lutherans, the Presbyterians. In our country, the Baptists are one of those today that just kind of, you know, we're okay with the traditional systems, and we're going to do reform from within. We're going to try and progress from within, or maybe we're not. Maybe we're just happy being the way we are. And then you're going to have all those others that say, well, let's go academic. Well, let's go charismatic or spiritist. And the others will say, let's do church, but let's get away from all this tradition and denominational naming and title and everything. For 200 years, 1600 to 1800, this is predominantly what's going on in the European church, and also as the church is spreading, all right? 1600 to 1800, obviously, we have colonies popping up here that are in large part of religious persuasion. The French are coming over here, and they're wanting to set up Catholic colonies. The Church of England is coming over here, and it's wanting to set up Anglican colonies. And as you'll see tonight, other groups came over and tried to set up freedom of religion colonies. We always say people were coming here looking for freedom of religion. There were a lot of settlers that were, but not all of them were. Some of them were coming over here trying to set up a new England or a new France or a new Spain. And if Spain and France are Catholic over there, they sure wanted it to be Catholic over here. If England was Anglican over there, they sure wanted it to be. And Anglican and Church of England are not synonymous, but I kind of think of them as such. So all that being said, this set of notes from this lecture, this is there are three chapters in the book. They run this rational approach, spiritist approach, pietist approach. And we're really just going to consider the first two tonight. On this set of lectures, he refers to this as the philosophic approach. Philosophic, rational, based in reason. They're all kind of the same. Within Lutheranism and some of the other traditions, you'd see this referred to as scholasticism, that we can really identify who we are and what we believe by this new understanding of the world around us. You see scholasticism there. The Renaissance, of course, taking place in the arts, helped kind of feed this. Galileo was a key figure there. Rationalism, an early figure. This is born in 1596. His time of influence wasn't until the 1600s, is René Descartes. If you're mathematicians, engineers, you know Descartes more for math than you do theology. But he was a very religious guy. Placed a lot of confidence in mathematical reasoning. And as such, his view was anything that we cannot be absolutely certain of, we should doubt. And so Descartes begins with himself. He says, the one thing I can be absolutely sure of is me. I am here doubting and thinking and processing, so I'm confident that I'm here. That was the one thing he could be sure of. His statement in Latin was cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. But whereas we would think, you know, most rationalists would go from self somewhere else, Descartes' second surety was God. That if in my mind I can fathom that I can fathom and I think that there's something greater than me, something, a more perfect example of me and humanity, something that's out there, then it must be so. I've experienced it. It can be proven, and therefore I no longer doubt that God exists. Peculiar that he would go there, number two. God, the one thing that many academicians today would say ought to be pretty high up on the list of doubt, Descartes eliminated quickly. You see under the notes there on Descartes, his basic approach, two important concepts, his process for discovering certainty, the relationship between spirit and matter. He believed that that human beings are, that there's the part of me that thinks, and so that is spirit, and there's the part of me that acts, and that is physical. And so how do the two, spirit and matter, how do they communicate? How do they cooperate? This created a lot of philosophical debate for him and for a lot of others. I don't know that any consensus were reached. Number two, his process for discovering certainties. You see cogito ergo sum there in A1. Conceived of a more perfect being than himself, B. That's, if there's a more perfect being than himself, it must be God. And then finally, to proving the existence of the world and his own body. Part of what would make Descartes important was not so much his theological beliefs, but what his theological beliefs would have, how they would affect other people. relationship between spirit and matter you see on the next page. Look at number four. Cartesianism was condemned by Orthodox Roman Catholics. You think, what does a mathematic system have to do with the Catholic Church, and why would they care? But in his case, Cartesianism wasn't just about math. It was about this philosophical point that says, I am going to doubt everything until I can prove it. And then when I prove it, then I will be certain that it is real. Well, for the Catholic Church, this sounded very skeptical, sounded very much like it would lead people astray if they're doubting the Pope, if they're doubting the bishops, if they're doubting the Catholic Church, if they're doubting the Trinity, if they're doubting the virgin birth, if we're doubting, you know, all these other things. But this was one of the first times really in the bigger sphere of things where people would begin, were encouraged to approach spirituality of any kind from a position of doubt first, and then working towards belief. Prior to that, you just believed because that's what we've always believed. It was tradition, it's the church, it's the spiritual community. You think about how big of a switch that was and how influential that's been on our society. Where do people predominantly operate today? Do we start from belief or do we start from doubt? I mean, most people don't think of themselves as Cartesianist philosophers, but most people in our country are. We say, unless I can see it and touch it and feel it with my own hands, I doubt that it is real. And so Descartes had a lot of, this was a big paradigm shift in the way people thought about religion. Um, 4b, these are others trying to explain his relationship between spirit and matter. You can kind of read through those in the book if you'd like. Occasionalism would say, really, your spirit and your body are totally distinct, and what God does is when your spirit thinks or decides to act, then God forces your body to move. On the occasion that your spirit decides, then God causes your body to move. You see that on C2, body and soul do not communicate directly, just by divine intervention. That didn't get a whole lot of support, by the way. The second one, monism, this is another key philosophical name. Spinoza tried to come up with a philosophical way of understanding spirit and body as being one, the same. They're all part of one entity, and so there's not a problem with them communicating. They may be two elements, but they are part of one thing. You see his example on number one at the bottom of the page. Body and soul are merely two different attributes of that one substance, just like red and round are two different qualities of an apple. Again, I don't know that comparing spirit and body to color and size are, that's not exactly comparing apples to apples, if I can use that pun at this point. But that was Spinoza's idea. Again, he didn't get a whole lot of followers. The third one on the next page, pre-established harmony. A philosopher named Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. You can read his concept. The universe consists of an infinite number of substances which are independent of each other. His was really ethereal. I'm not sure I entirely understood what it was he was arguing. In the end, his critique was God simply has foreordained all things, so we shouldn't worry about it. Anyways, Descartes' influence would lead to this next system of philosophy, empiricism. If we're going to start off from doubt, then John Locke, roughly the same time and following Descartes, John Locke comes along and he says, well, how then can we know something? If we're going to doubt everything until we have proven it, until we know it, how can we know? How can we know? Can I know that the price of tea in China is a certain amount? Can we know that? Can we know that, can we know that something for sure is going on in Florida? Well, I see it on TV, but how do we know that that's not a fictional story being made up somewhere? How do I know that that's not, can I really know that? The only way, and Locke's conclusion, his philosophy of empiricism was the only way we can know something is if you tangibly experience it. Now, Locke was okay with saying that there are things where we have judgment and there are things where we have faith, but those are based on things that we don't know. Very, very rigid definition of know. No, knowledge comes from experience. If I watch a program, I watch the news on TV and it's telling me something's taking place in New York, I can use my judgment and assume that that is correct and make a judgment call based on a lot of information, but that's not the same thing as knowledge. If I take a whole lot of information and there's no concrete information, but I'm going to make a call, then that might be a point of faith. But for me to know something, I have to know it by experiencing it. I think what I just said, if you look at number one, John Locke, English Protestant, his approach, look at C. All knowledge was derived from experience. Empiricism is just comes from the Greek word for experience. That's what that philosophical idea or this system is called. Therefore, the basic problem in philosophy is to explain the relationship of experience to knowledge. Experience is one of two types. Could be an outward, perceived by the five senses. An outward experience could be an inner experience by which we know ourselves and the functioning of our mind. Experiences can be at three different levels. He identified self, outer reality, and even God, proven moment to moment by the existence of self and one's experiences. It's funny how for Descartes and Locke, these philosophical points that were such radical departures from the way people thought, to them, were not a hindrance to their faith or their belief in God. But how those same ways of thinking today, people would say, well, you can't experience God, therefore you can't know that God exists. And as a Christian, you know, community, how do we respond to that? Well, you can say, I have experienced something unique that I identify as divine or I identify as God. But ultimately, it kind of comes back around to, on the next page, at D, it comes back to faith. Faith is assent to knowledge derived from revelation rather than from reason. Knowledge derived from this, we might deduce, is highly probable or marginally probable, but we would never say is absolutely certain. This, again, we kind of take for granted as even the Christian community today. We would say, yeah, there's a whole lot of places reason can take us and thinking about God and the church and the divine. But in the end, it can't be proven, courtroom proven. I mean, it can't be proven the way he's defining knowledge as experience. There does come a point at which you have to make a decision based on faith when it comes to the divine. For us, we take that for granted. 1600s, this is a pretty radical departure. Everybody just assumed that what the church tells us is correct, that God is up there and that Jesus died. And faith, but faith wasn't much of a factor at all. This way of Western philosophy, Western thinking, last October, before I went to Thailand, I was doing some reading just on Buddhism and Buddhist philosophy, and one thing I read was written by a Christian writer who had been Buddhist before and transitioned out of Buddhism into Christianity, and he said one of the things Western theologians, Western Christians really want to, they'll go to the scriptures, go to the stories, go to the teachings, and then they'll come into these Eastern, predominantly Buddhist countries and point out rational flaws in their system of thinking, as though that should convince an Eastern-minded, spiritual person that they should change. If your system of belief, if your religion isn't rationally cogent, then you should search for one that is. But, he said, the problem is they don't care. Whether or not it's rational, whether or not you can connect the dots to them makes no sense at all. It's of little value. What is of more value is that their faith tells them what to do, that they know what to do. They know how to worship. They know how to think. They know how to interact in their society. And with that, you can understand, if you go back to our guest that spoke about Hinduism and how Hinduism as a faith and Indian culture as a nationality are inseparable. It's the same way in Thailand with Thai Buddhism. It's the same way in Japan. It's the same way in China. It's the same way for a lot of predominantly Muslim countries. For us as Americans, we can separate what it means to be a patriotic, national American and what it means to be a Christian. We separate the two. But in a lot of the rest of the world, your faith and your nationality are so intertwined that to separate them would destroy both. This is why there are Muslim terrorist groups that, as they're trying to make war with Christianity, they make war with the United States. They see the two as one and the same. And us over here, we would say, really? There's fewer people that are Christians, that fewer people that are Christians than not in our country. We are more and more and more a secular society than anything. But their worldview is, whatever religion you're most known for and your country, they are one and the same. I think about that this dynamic that in the Western world we so recognize, well, we're going to rationally get there, and if I can't be given reasonable sense that this spiritual thing makes sense, then I'm not going to follow it. In a lot of the other world religion parts of the world, they don't care. Rationalism or reason to their faith. Now, that is changing. As the world is getting smaller, as people are traveling all over the place, as younger generations are coming up and education is going up and walls are coming down. So that is changing, but still in a lot of the world where Descartes and Locke moved us as a Western society, there are still pockets of the world today that are not there. Yeah. Yeah, the question is that because their cultures kind of inhibited the education? Yes and no. I mean, education in a state that is informed by its religion, obviously, education in that country is going to lean towards whatever that religion holds to be true. And so, the fact, would they make it illegal? I don't know. I'm sure there are instances where it was. There are probably other instances where it was a little bit more freedom. Much of the story of Africa is the Christian church, European Christian church, sending missionaries into all these African countries, and what they would do is they'd go in and set up hospitals and they'd set up schools. And so, but those are not countries where Hinduism and Islam and Buddhism were predominant. That was more tribal religion. And so, a Christian missionary group could come in and offer to set up a hospital, and man, absolutely. And they'll offer to set up a school, and a school was the front door by which we can teach people to read, and we teach people to read by helping them read the Bible. Literacy was a vehicle by which we could also share our religious beliefs. And you might think of that as a positive, you might think of that as a negative. It depends on one's perspective. But if you know the story of Nelson Mandela well, Nelson Mandela was a poor, living in a township, nowhere, little Zulu boy that was picked up and taken to a private Christian school and educated in a school that was only there because of a Christian group, and that's where his education began, which would lead to all of the other, things that he was able to do for his own country. I mean, he became, a pivotal figure for that whole country, all of which, or very little of which, would never have happened had it not been for Christians being over there educating kids that didn't have an opportunity to be educated. So, that's empiricism. John Locke, you see his his opinions of Christianity there. He would say Christianity is the most reasonable of all religions. Not that we can know it, but it is the most reasonable of all. But he would say number three is important because that's going to be another step in the direction we're moving. Christianity is little more than the clear expression of truths or laws that can be known by natural faculties rightly exercised. In other words, the system of Christianity doesn't add anything to what we should already know just from common sense. Be nice to one another, love one another, don't steal. God is out there. Just so if you think there's a problem there, it's a nice idea. The problem is that it eliminates any special revelation in Scripture, and the nature of Jesus, the work of Jesus, the death and resurrection of Christ are all revelations that are only revealed in the Bible. They're not revealed in nature nor human nature. And so where Locke kind of suggested that Christianity's great, it's reasonable, but you ought to be able to figure this out on your own kind of deal. It's wrapped up in human nature. That's going to lead to a religious movement, not just a philosophy. G, referred to as deism. Deism. That God is out there, but that God, if God is the God of all nations, then his system ought to be easily obtainable and recognizable by all people everywhere. Deism is not universalism, but it's pretty close. It's kind of between Christianity and universalism. It's as amorphous and broad as Christianity could be. You see, appeared in England during the 17th century. They're called deists or free thinkers because they were opposed to atheism, that we believe in God, but they also were opposed to the narrow limits of orthodoxy that all these churches were setting up. Shouldn't, if God really is out there and the God of all people, shouldn't the pathway to God be a little bit more broad than just this systematic theology that the Calvinists have set up? Shouldn't it be more broad than just this system the Catholics have set up or any other group or religion? And I would guess that as we move further and further into the 21st century in our country, a lot of people feel the same way. Oh, I believe in God and I believe in Jesus, but it sure's, you know, the Baptists, they sure talk like they have cornered the market on what's right on the way to God. Or the Presbyterians, they've got it all figured out and their way is the right way to God. And the deists would say, we're opposed to atheism, but we're also opposed to this real narrow-minded orthodoxy, what appears to us to be real narrow-minded orthodoxy. Yeah. I was going there. Yeah. This is important because Ben Franklin is typically identified as a deist. Thomas Jefferson, you know, I mean, he had a Bible and he would go in and cut out parts that he didn't like and keep parts that he did like, particularly some of the supernatural stuff. That's not reasonable. And so he would kind of cut and paste. And it's not that they were religious men. They were theists. They believed in God. But that they were Orthodox Christians or Protestant Christians, and there were certainly those who were. But in many other cases, deism is a better acknowledgement of their religious persuasion. So, yeah. Yeah. There's a sense in which for us as Baptists, we're unique as a Baptist church. Some of you guys didn't grow up in the Baptist world, but man, 30 years ago as a kid in a Southern Baptist church, the Baptists really did, and in some conservative places still do, have a reputation of having this idea that we are right and everybody else, if you're not where we are, everybody else is wrong. Now, I should also say there are other groups that think that much more vehemently than Baptists do. And I won't name them by name. I'll call Baptists just because I am one, and I can talk about my own. But there are other Christian groups that even today would say, if you believe like us, you're in. If you don't believe like us, you're out. But for us as a church, I mean, we would say, you know what? You can be Catholic and be a disciple of Jesus as a Catholic. We theologically will not agree on everything. And I might think that you're wrong on some things, but I don't think that means that you can't be saved by the grace of God, following Christ with your life, making an impact on the kingdom of God. And you know, I mean, I might not agree with my Presbyterian friend on all their theological points or a Methodist friend on all their theological points, but I would never think that because they're Presbyterian or Methodist, they can't be Christian. You only can be a Christian if you're a Baptist. And so I would stop short of saying that I'm a deist, because I do think that theology matters, and I do not think all roads are equal and all roads are leading to the same place within Christianity. But I do try to acknowledge that our salvation is by grace, not by knowledge or theology. And I don't have all the answers. I don't know everything. Contrary to opinion, to public opinion, there's a lot of stuff. And man, I will not be surprised if I get to heaven and find out that I've been thinking something entirely, completely wrong. But what I'm doing is the very best I can with all the information at our disposal in the 21st century, instead of saying we're going to do the best we can with the information at the disposal of figures in the 16th century, and we're just going to follow behind them. That being said, I mean, there are some noble qualities to deism, but in their world, it was not as admirable as I think. It could have been. It was much more of a, we want people to quit arguing and fighting, and so we're going to be all accepting of any road that is quasi following God. Some different advocates. The five basic tenets you see at the bottom of that page. These were the five things they would say should be knowable by human reason. And so if you adhere to these five basic tenets, then we are going to believe that you're a Christian. Existence of God, obligation to worship God, ethical requirements resulting from worship, that you have to live well, live a good life, need for repentance, when we discover that we've done something wrong, we should quit doing that, and rewards and punishment, both in this life and in the life to come. Notice that this system of belief, from a religious point of view, is following in some regard behind John Locke's empiricism. These five things you can learn from the Bible, but you should also be able to learn these without the Bible. And these are the five tenets. And what you'll notice is conspicuously absent from the deist's five points is any reference at all to the role played by Jesus of Nazareth. That's in the Bible. That can't be known as general revelation. That can only be known as special revelation from Scripture. And so we're not incorporating that here. Therein is where we would break from deists. We would say this is a good start, but you're missing a very, very important piece, probably the important piece. Some other names: John Toland, Roman Catholic Irishman. Matthew Tyndall there as well. John Biddle, an early English Unitarianism. Unitarianism would then be the next move from deism. Deism is at least keeping it in-house within Christianity, but it's a pretty easy step from deism to Unitarianism or Universalism. David Hume, another philosopher mentioned there, I took John Locke and basically exaggerated his ideas of empiricism. David Hume would become a little bit more atheist and anti-religious based on Locke's philosophies. Next page, you see J, movements in France. These things were going on in England, predominantly in France. You have Voltaire. Voltaire was just a satirist. Kind of like Chris Rock at the Academy Awards, man. He just pointed out the ridiculousness of everybody, of all of this. You know, the Academy for doing this, and Will Smith for this, and, you know, the black community for this, and the white community for this, and everybody for this and this. That's what Voltaire did. And you know, if the French king is executing Protestants, he looks at that and says, that's ridiculous. Why are we doing this? And so he'd speak out against the king and in favor of Protestantism. But then he would see Protestant groups doing silly things or foolish things, and he would call that out. I was taught in Western Civ, I don't know if I was taught this, I just presumed that he was an atheist writer. I don't know that Voltaire was an atheist writer so much as he was just very, very critical of the world around him. And he's a good example of an early thinker that we see today that looked at all the negative things that came along with Christianity and just said, all of that is so negative, I can't get behind this. All of this inquisition and executions and religious wars and people fighting with one another, if that's the church, I just can't get behind it. And he and I would agree. It's just that I would say that's not the essence of the church. But that if that's what you have to go on, if that is your idea of the essence of the church, I think a lot of people in America, their reaction to the Christian church is not based on what we would say is the essential church. Their reaction is based on a lot of the negative things that come out of any kind of religion, and they see that in Christianity and respond to it in a way similar to Voltaire. Montesquieu, number two, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, these are some of the same kind of rational movements taking place in France. It kind of culminates on the next page with Immanuel Kant. Kant was a German philosopher. He was not crazy about the empirical view. He was not crazy about the Cartesian method. And so he tried to come up with an alternative system. You see this under on number three. He would say there's no such thing as innate ideas, but he elevates the use of reason. Therefore, it was a mixture of empiricism and reason. It's a mixture of experience and reason. He's taking a little bit of Descartes and a little bit of Locke and kind of hybridizing them. He would say there are fundamental structures of the mind which perceive things in such terms as time and space. Experiences are disordered sense impressions. Look at number at D. There is no such thing as objective knowledge. Rather, there are only ideas or things as our minds grasp them. Kant was a spiritual guy. You see there, four, he would say pure reason cannot prove things such as the existence of God. However, practical reason can. We can't know it from pure reason. But all these things like the moral life, ethical behavior, give evidence to religion. And so Kant was a spiritual man. He was believed to be a Christian. But he would say, based on experiences and based on rationale, those two things alone can't get you there. At some point, you just kind of have to make a faith call. Again, not too different from Locke, but he would at least acknowledge that you can know things beyond just experience. You can know things beyond just reason. The two kind of go together. The problem is, if you put those two things into the mixer for any single individual, this person's experiences and reason are going to be completely unique and isolated to them and totally different from somebody else. And so if that's the case, if everybody's collection of experiences and rationale are unique, then how can we really objectively know anything? It's all about, to me, it's a similar argument when we talk about historiography, the writing of history. Well, the writing of history is always biased. And so what can we really know about history? We're always reading it through the lens, you know, for ancient history, it's always written by the victors. The people who win the wars are the ones telling the stories. Who's to say they didn't embellish them a little bit, exaggerate them a little bit? Can we objectively know that things happen exactly the way historians tell them? At the same time, does that mean we can't trust history? I mean, we do know that, you know, the Revolutionary War happened, and we do know that the Civil War happened, and we do know, you know, the major movements and sweeping things. But Kant kind of, you know, he was a product of all of the 1600s. Moving into the 1700s, he kind of took everything and tried to put it together and make sense of it, but give an alternative way. I don't know how helpful, if you guys have had much philosophy, if you had to take philosophy in college, in grad school, if you've ever read philosophy, these are major names. Descartes, Locke, Hume, Kant, these are major, major names in the philosophical world. But what they have, what they deal for us in the theological world, sometimes it's tough to get your head around because it's really heady, you know, brainy kind of stuff, ethereal stuff. But this was the attempt to respond to all of this other religious stuff by thinking, we can get there with our mind. We can get there with our mind. We can get there with our brain. The spiritualist approach, without going into as great a length there because we're out of time, you see number two. These were usually born out of less educated communities, and so in some cases more poverty-based communities. The three names that Gonzalez mentions, one of them you see on the next page, Jacob. I think you pronounce his name Berm. Bam? I'm going to go with the musician in the room. I'm going to go with your pronunciation of German names. Oddly enough, both him and George Fox were cobblers, worked with shoes. But their response was to this dogma that it didn't have any emotion, it didn't have any feeling. And so they just, you know, they looked and said, the Bible is good, but what's really most important is what the Holy Spirit is telling you in your spirit, the inner self. And so if any of you guys have done some of the Renovari stuff, the books, they've been within our church, we've done them. Some people love them, some people hate them. But some of the writers they use are people born out of this strain, a contemplative approach, quiet, Christian meditation, thinking, interacting with God. It is a good response to blind or just empty rationalism with no emotion. I think if we were to say which one of these two paths is better, we'd say the better path is a combination of both. The Bible says we should love God with all of our hearts, souls, and minds, which does imply an inner spiritual component, but also a mental, rational component. And we ought to be able to do both. What you have in these two approaches is people taking one completely to the exclusion of the other, and the reactions were mixed at best. Really, the big one here is C. George Fox, because and Fox was in England, and Fox's followers would become known as the Friends. Apart from orthodoxy and belief, we should love one another, take care of one another. We should abandon anything traditional. Their worship services were known for people just sitting in the room and being quiet until someone felt like the Spirit was telling them to speak, and then they would stand up and speak and then sit back down. And people would come from all over to hear George Fox. In some worship services, he wouldn't even get up and say anything. The Spirit didn't tell him to. This was one of the early, very social justice-minded groups that came out of the Reformation. Fox's group would be known as the Friends, but because they were so zealous with their passion for the Lord that they would tremble or shake, they earned the name the Quakers. And Fox would travel around and find adherents and followers, had followers all over Europe and even in North America. So you see some of the practices mentioned there at the bottom. Fox is also important for us. On the next page, number seven, one of his key disciples was a man named William Penn. And William Penn was a Puritan, and then he moved to France, and he became a Huguenot, and then he moved back to England and became a Quaker, was imprisoned because of his Puritan affiliations. Whenever he finally got out of prison, he came from a well-to-do family, and the king owed him, Charles II owed him a lot of money, but didn't want to pay him. And so what William Penn did was he said, I will take, in lieu of the money you owe me, a land grant in the New World, in the colony of Pennsylvania, and we're going to have this experiment. We're going to go into create this colony of Pennsylvania, and it is going to be a place of religious freedom for anybody to worship however they want. And so, for George Fox was very passionate, very spiritual, a little bit weird. But William Penn came over, for all the stories about how horribly we treated the Native Americans, William Penn came over with land granted to him by the king, but said, I'm still going to pay the Native Americans for the land that we occupy because I believe it belongs to them first, and we're going to pay for it. And part of our experiment is going to be to develop good relationships with the Native Americans that are here. We're going to work with them and love them and care for them and interact with them. And so this, came to be the experiment that was Pennsylvania, allowed religious toleration for all. The Quakers were persecuted in other places, Massachusetts in particularly, and they chose to name their capital city because of the Quaker idea, the Friends idea, the city of brotherly love. And so Pennsylvania was founded and Philadelphia was made its capital city. So, interesting. William Penn's a fascinating character. If you like reading biographies or want to do some more reading or research on any of these characters we come across in this study, he's a good one. I would encourage you to do that. Emanuel Swedenborg was kind of like, he was a Spiritist as well, but based in Sweden, had a group of followers called the New Church of Jerusalem, Church of the New Jerusalem, under number 4. And it's very small, obviously much smaller than the Friends Church, but does still exist. So you see the impact on E, only the Quakers made significant impact over a long time because their emphasis on the community of believers and their interest in rectifying social problems. So the rational approach, the spiritist approach, and then we will come back and visit the pietist approach another night. So hope you guys have a great rest of your week. We'll look forward to worshiping with you on Sunday if you can be here. If not, we will be on break next Wednesday for spring break, and we'll reconvene 2 weeks from tonight.